Well, good morning, Rock Hill Superior. It is a joy to be with you all today. If I haven't had the chance to meet you, my name is Thor Anderson. I'm a pastoral resident here at the church. I've been able to come over to Rock Hill Superior a couple times in the past year. I'm just about at the one-year mark of my residency. Spend most of my time over there in Lincoln Park, but I've really enjoyed the opportunities I've had to come over here across the bridge and join you all for worship. And man, my ministry training was in a Southern Baptist school, and this morning kind of feels like this heat's going to bring out some of the Southern Baptist in me, you know? We got the fans going, using the brochures to fan ourselves. Unfortunately, I don't have my handkerchief with me, otherwise I could get that out, kind of dab the forehead, something like that. But in the spirit of thinking about being a little bit more Southern Baptist, I'm going to ask you all this morning to do something that might feel a little bit uncomfortable. We're going to start out with a bit of a call and response exercise. Now, I know this is the upper Midwest, where typically the most reaction we give to a sermon is maybe a little head nod here or there. But don't worry, I don't think what I'm going to ask you to do is that difficult. I am simply going to say some recognizable song lyrics that I'm going to point at you, and you're going to complete those lyrics. All right? So if I, for example, were to say, "Sweet Caroline." Exactly. Great. You got it. So starting off here, don't leave me hanging. I don't believe you will. If there's something strange in the neighborhood, who are you going to call? If there's something weird and it don't look good, who are you going to call? Now, some of you might be sitting here thinking to yourself, why in the world are we shouting out Ghostbusters lyrics in church? That's an excellent question. It's because I want to title this morning's message, "Who Are You Gonna Call?" Who are you gonna call? The entire theme song of the Ghostbusters theme revolves around this one silly little question. In the event of something spooky or supernatural, who are you going to call? For example, if you were to see Slimer or the giant Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, would you call pest control? Probably not. 911? Okay, that's a better option, but still probably not the most effective. No, if you're living in that fictional world and you're dealing with a ghostly nuisance, you want to call the Ghostbusters. And friends, as we look at Isaiah chapters 30 and 31 this morning, we will see that God's people had a choice regarding who they were going to call. You see, at this point in history, the people of God were facing down a terrifying enemy, the kingdom of Assyria. These were the big bad guys of the ancient world. They were kind of like the ancient equivalent of the Nazis, a gigantic, conquering, militaristic empire that was notoriously cruel. And God's people, living in the kingdom of Judah, were facing them down. A tiny little nation versus a vicious, militaristic juggernaut. But like a contestant struggling on a game show, the Lord's people had the option to phone a friend. They had two options before them. They could either call on the nation of Egypt for military help, or they could call on the Lord God himself. Two options and one question. Who are you going to call? There's one main takeaway from the situation that we'll be studying this morning. I believe it's this. Call on the Lord in times of trouble, because everything else will eventually let you down. That is the message that the prophet Isaiah had for God's people as they were considering who to call on. And I think it's just as true for us living thousands of years later. When we are faced with problems, when we are faced with disaster, who will we call? Call on the Lord in times of trouble, because everything else will eventually let you down. We'll explore this idea today in four movements. First, we'll see how material help is temporary. Second, sinful help is destructive. Third, divine help is potent. And finally, divine help is unearned. Let's begin by looking at that first point. Material help is temporary. While preparing this sermon and studying these two chapters, I came to realize that they're not very linear. It's not a point A to point B to point C situation when we're reading Isaiah 30 and 31. Instead, 31 is basically a restatement of everything that's in chapter 30. It's like a shorter, abridged version of the chapter that came before. So instead of going verse by verse this morning, instead, what I want to do is go theme by theme. So that means we're going to be jumping around to different verses in these two chapters, and that might feel a little bit strange to us who are used to going verse by verse. But I actually think it's how this kind of poetry is intended to be written. You see, Hebrew poetry is far less of a linear structure where you're following the flow of thought, and Hebrew poetry is much more cyclical. It comes back to the same themes over and over again. And I think we are intended to study this poetry by thinking deeply about the themes that are repeatedly brought up. And that first theme that Isaiah speaks about in these chapters is the reality that material help is temporary. You see, while God's people were considering asking Egypt for help, look at what Isaiah says. He says, Egypt's promises are worthless. What sorrow awaits those who look to Egypt for help, trusting in their horses, chariots, and charioteers, depending on the strength of human armies, instead of looking to the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. And then he says, for these Egyptians are mere humans, not God. Their horses are puny flesh, not mighty spirits. Receiving help from the Egyptians seemed wise because they had a strong military. But God says, while Egypt appeared strong, they were in fact weak. He says in 30 verse 7 that Egypt's promises are worthless. And interestingly, the Hebrew word that is used for worthless here is the Hebrew word hevel, which is used frequently in the book of Ecclesiastes. Maybe you've heard about it reading that book. In Ecclesiastes, it's frequently translated as meaningless. And literally, the word hevel means vapor or smoke or mist, something that you can see with your eyes, but when you reach out to grab it, it's not really there. Egypt appeared to be a present and true help, but the reality was they wouldn't come through. And historically, this was proven true. While Egypt was initially able to stand up to the kingdom of Assyria, eventually they folded. In 671 BC, Assyria marched into Egypt and sent Pharaoh and his royal family off into captivity. And even if Egypt had been able to defend its borders, even if Egypt had been able to go blow for blow with Assyria, they still wouldn't have been able to help Israel. That's because Egypt's military strength was in their chariots. But if you just take a look at a picture of the geography, the topography of Israel, you'll see why chariots would not have been a great help. The terrain is far too rough for chariots and horses to defend a country like Israel. So although Egypt appeared to be strong, although they projected strength, the reality was they were all bark and no bite. When we're faced with problems, it's human nature to look for solutions that are quick, easy, and appear strong. We're often tempted to go towards those convenient fixes. And that's what Egypt was for God's people. It was a quick and convenient fix, but I'm sure many of you know a quick fix is rarely a permanent one. And guys, that is the issue with relying on material help. It's not necessarily that material help is wrong all the time, but the problem is our expectations. When we expect material solutions to be a permanent fix, when we think that the vacation we're going on will magically fix a struggling marriage, when we think a new job will suddenly end all of our career frustrations, when we think this new relationship will finally bring the love that I've been looking for all my life. But guys, none of these things can truly solve these problems. Nothing from this world can completely solve the deepest issues that we deal with, because everything is impermanent. Like a flower in bloom, it all eventually wilts. And that's why Isaiah reminded Judah, for these Egyptians are mere humans. They're mere humans who will one day die, who will grow weak. They're not God. Their horses are just puny flesh, not mighty, everlasting spirits. Egypt could never be the permanent answer to Assyria. And we can make the same mistake today. We think a degree or better physical health or deeper friendships or even therapy, we think these are the solutions that will bring us lasting life change. And all of those things are good, but they are not God. They cannot cause the lasting life change that we are looking for. If we expect anything other than the Lord to be a cure-all, we're going to be let down. This is one of the reasons why it was so foolish for God's people to call on Egypt for help. But there was another, more sinister reason why it was wrong to look to Egypt for help. For that, let's turn to our second point today. Sinful help is destructive. Across both chapters 30 and 31, God makes it clear that trusting in Egypt is not only unwise, but it is rebellious. Just look at 30 verse 1. What sorrow awaits my rebellious children, says the Lord. You make plans that are contrary to mine. You make alliances not directed by my spirit, thus piling up your sins. The Lord describes his people as rebellious, as sinful, for considering Egypt's aid. And that's because going back to Egypt had been explicitly forbidden by the Lord. If we take a look at Deuteronomy 17, verse 16, we'll see this command, which was given to the king of God's people. God said, "The king must not build up a large stable of horses for himself or send his people to Egypt to buy horses." Does that remind you of what Israel was considering in this moment, considering going to Egypt and buying their horses, buying their chariots, buying their military's aid? The end of verse 16 in Deuteronomy 17 says, "The Lord has told you, you must never return to Egypt." To call on Egypt's aid was to violate a clear command of God not to return. For the kingdom of Judah, Egypt wasn't just a materialistic help, it was a sinful help. And it was going to result in their destruction. We all have those sins that call to us when we're feeling overwhelmed, don't we? Those familiar lies that promise safety, security, and relief. One of my favorite musical artists is Johnny Cash, and he struggled with this during his lifetime. As his musical career expanded and as he took on more and more touring opportunities, the stress of life got to him, and he began taking pills so that he could stay awake, and pills so that he could go back to bed. And over time, what had started as something that helped manage his stress turned into a dependency. It turned into an addiction. And it was only through the help of family, friends, and reconnection with his faith that he was able to overcome. Now, maybe substance abuse isn't what you turn to in times of stress, but by the way, if it is, I want to say you're welcome in this church. And I know there are other folks who are attending Rock Hill who have walked through similar struggles. But whatever your temptation is, everybody has some kind of sin that we gravitate towards when we are feeling overwhelmed by life. And for God's people in the Old Testament, Egypt was that common temptation. But remember, to return to Egypt meant a return to the place of captivity for Israel. The people of God had been slaves in Egypt for hundreds of years, so to go back to Egypt was to go back to a place of slavery. The foolishness of such a move is portrayed in Isaiah 30, verse 6 and following. There we read this: the caravan moves slowly across the terrible desert to Egypt, donkeys weighed down with riches and camels loaded with treasure, all to pay for Egypt's protection. They travel through the wilderness, a place of lionesses and lions, a place of vipers and poisonous snakes where they live, and all this, and Egypt will give you nothing in return. Egypt's promises are worthless. Therefore, I call her Rahab, the harmless dragon. These verses are filled with imagery that recall God's people's exodus out from Egypt. When God freed them from Egypt, they wandered through the wilderness, through a wilderness that was filled with beasts and snakes. And in choosing to come back to Egypt for aid, God's people were symbolically choosing to go back to a place of captivity. And this is why sinful relief is so destructive, because it calls us to return to things that once held us in bondage. When you give in to that anger that you've worked so hard to overcome, you return to slavery. When you pick up the bottle after years of fighting an addiction, you return to slavery. When you come back to the compulsive shopping that you have reined in over time, you return to slavery. And you know what? None of these things will ever meaningfully help against the challenges of life. Their promises are worthless. Like Egypt, sinful help will give you nothing in return. One of the best ways to not fall back into a sinful pattern of life is remembering how terrible it was. Remember what that former way of life was like and how it left such a bitter taste in your mouth. One of the reasons God's people were considering going back to Egypt was that they were living deliberately blind. Instead of recalling their former slavery, we see in verse 30, in chapter 30, verse 10, that they tell the prophets, "Don't tell us what is right. Tell us nice things. Tell us lies." But brothers and sisters, when we refuse to believe the lies, when we remember how terrible our sin was, then we can resist the temptation of sinful help. As God's people considered the threat of the Assyrian Empire, Egypt appeared to be the only option. But in reality, that wasn't true. These chapters in Isaiah present a far greater and glorious help that was available to the people of God. Let's now take a look at that alternative option, God himself. Something that becomes abundantly clear in chapters 30 and 31 of Isaiah is that divine help is potent. Just listen to the power in these words. And I'm going to quote from a very large section of Isaiah chapter 30. And I encourage you, don't necessarily think about all the logical progressions in these verses. Just feel the weight, feel the power of what I'm about to read. "Look, the Lord is coming from far away, burning with anger, surrounded by a thick rising smoke. His lips are filled with fury. His words consume like fire. His hot breath pours out like a flood up to the neck of his enemies. He will sift out the proud nations for destruction. He will bridle them and lead them away to ruin. But the people of God will sing a song of joy. Like the songs at holy festivals, you will be filled with joy, as when the flutist leads a group of pilgrims to Jerusalem, to the mountain of the Lord, to the rock of Israel. And the Lord will make his majestic voice heard. He will display the strength of his mighty arm. It will descend with devouring flames, with cloudbursts, thunderstorms and huge hailstones. At the Lord's command, the Assyrians will be shattered. He will strike them down with his royal scepter. And as the Lord strikes them with his rod of punishment, his people will celebrate with tambourines and harps. Lifting his mighty arm, he will fight the Assyrians. Topheth, the place of burning, has long been ready for the Assyrian king. The pyre is piled high with wood. The breath of the Lord, like a fire from a volcano, will set it ablaze. Wow. That is the kind of power you want on your side when the ancient equivalent of the Nazis are at your doorstep. That is the kind of power that the Lord was offering to Israel. God's strength against the Assyrians would be like putting out a little campfire with a fire hose. It would completely obliterate them. And God's people wouldn't even have to lift a finger. If you've read the Bible, this doesn't come as a surprise to you. Because time and time again, the Lord proves his ability to absolutely eviscerate the problems that his people face. This is the same God who split open a sea so his people could walk through on dry ground. This is the same God who allowed his servants to be thrown into a blazing furnace and walk out without a whiff of smoke on them. This is the same God who brought down prison walls so that his followers could walk out free men. If you read throughout the Bible, you will see God always, always, always comes through when his people need him the most. And the kingdom of Judah was uncertain if they should call on him for aid. They were heavily considering Egypt's help instead. And so often, we also neglect the power that is available to us if we were to just simply ask. You know, chapter 31 of Isaiah describes God as a powerful lion ready to defend his people. He says, when a strong lion stands growling over a sheep, it is killed, it is not frightened by the shouts and noise of a whole crowd of shepherds. In the same way, the Lord of heaven's armies will come down and fight on Mount Zion. God is available and ready to encircle and defend you today. But so often, we pick a little house cat to defend us instead of that powerful lion. When we're confronted with the big existential problems of life, why do we choose anything other than God? We see death in the world. We're confronted with our own mortality. And our solution is to stick our head in the sand and pretend like it's not coming. We recognize the feelings of loneliness and unsatisfaction that are in our hearts. And our solution is endless scrolling on social media. We feel insecure. We feel like our identity is threatened. And our solution is to pursue more achievements. All of these solutions are house cats. Meanwhile, there is a powerful lion ready to fight to the death for you this morning. Divine power is potent. No other help can rival what God offers. The Lord's hand was strong enough to completely crush the Assyrians. But his people had forgotten. Surprisingly, though, in spite of their forgetfulness, they were going to be rescued. And that's because divine help is not only potent, divine help is also unearned. Up until this point, we've seen God's people reject his help, right? They've chosen to willfully ignore God's power. They've considered blindly returning to the nation that once enslaved them. And so you'd expect these chapters to explode with judgment on the kingdom of Judah. And you know what? There's a little bit of that. I mean, this is Isaiah, after all. There's going to be some judgment towards the Lord's people. But in an unexpected plot twist, we read this in Isaiah 30. So the Lord must wait for you to come to him, so he can show you his love and compassion. For the Lord is a faithful God. Blessed are those who wait for his help. O people of Zion who live in Jerusalem, you will weep no more. He will be gracious if you ask for his help. He will surely respond to the sound of your cries. Though the Lord gave you adversity for food and suffering for drink, he will still be with you to teach you. You will see your teacher with your own eyes. Your own ears will hear him. Right behind you, a voice will say, "This is the way you should go, whether to the right or to the left." Then you will destroy all your silver idols and your precious gold images. You will throw them out like filthy rags, saying to them, "Good riddance." Then the Lord will bless you with a rain at planting time. There will be wonderful harvests and plenty of pasture land for your livestock. The oxen and donkeys that till the ground will eat good grain. Its chaff will be blown away by the wind. In that day when your enemies are slaughtered and the towers fall, there will be streams of water flowing down from every mountain and every hill. The moon will be as bright as the sun, and the sun will be seven times brighter, like the light of 7 days in one. So it will be when the Lord begins to heal his people and cure the wounds he gave them. What a beautiful and stunning passage. God promises a future where he will abundantly, out of his own goodness, provide everything that his people need. And all of it is unearned. Even though his people had forgotten his power, God would not forget their cries for help. As it says in verse 20, "Though the Lord gave you adversity for food and suffering for drink, he will still be with you to teach you." Even though his children had turned away and walked away from God, God would still remain with them. He would not turn his back on his wayward children. What I think is so remarkable about this is that God doesn't wait for his people to give up their sin. It says in verse 22 that his people destroy all their silver idols and that they throw away their precious gold images, saying to them, "Good riddance." But notice this is after God rescues them. He has compassion on them, and then they give up their idols. So God's salvation in this passage is not contingent upon his people's perfect obedience. And of course, we see this ultimately displayed in Jesus, don't we? Romans 5:8 tells us, "But God showed his great love for us by sending Christ to die for us while we were still sinners." Jesus didn't wait for us to get our act together before he came to earth. No, he freely laid down his life for all who would believe in his name, knowing that you and I would keep on sinning. Out of love, he went to the cross. Out of love, he died in our place. As he says in Isaiah 30, verse 31, verse 6, "Though you are such wicked rebels, my people, come and return to the Lord." In spite of your wickedness, there is the opportunity to return, because divine help is unearned. By the way, if you have questions about why Jesus' death was necessary for our salvation, or if you have questions about how you can be saved, I'd encourage you to just stay after the service. I'll be available to talk. I know Pastor Derek will be available to talk as well. I'm also pretty confident there are folks who are sitting around you in these chairs who would be honored to simply listen to your questions and hear what you have to say and share their own personal experience following Jesus. Call on the Lord in times of trouble, because everything else will let you down. We call on the Lord because material help is temporary. We call on the Lord because sinful help is destructive and because divine help is potent. But most of all, we call on the Lord in times of trouble because divine help is unearned. You never have to go to God and prove your worth for him to help you. He stands ready and available to assist you in whatever you're going through, if you were simply just to ask him. So I ask you, friends, what Assyrians are you facing down this morning? What is the overwhelming problem that is taking up your entire vision of the next week, that one thing that is weighing you down mentally, weighing you down emotionally, who are you going to call? Where will you turn first for help? In the book of 2 Kings, there's this interesting story about the prophet Elisha. Now, Elisha had ticked off. He had made a foreign king angry, and this foreign king sent an entire army to come surround the hill that Elisha lived on. And the Bible tells us that Elisha's servant got up early that next morning, and he went outside, and there were troops, horses, and chariots everywhere. "Oh, sir, what will we do now?" the young man cried to Elisha. What happened next is nothing short of amazing. "Don't be afraid," Elisha told him, "for there are more on our side than on theirs." Then Elisha prayed, "Oh Lord, open his eyes and let him see." And the Lord opened the young man's eyes, and when he looked up, he saw that the hillside around Elisha was filled with horses and chariots of fire. As the Aramean army advanced towards him, Elisha prayed, "Oh Lord, please make them blind." So the Lord struck them with blindness, as Elisha had asked. Do you see the two responses to a threat in this story? Elisha's unfazed. He's completely calm, cool, and collected because he knows that the Lord is with him. He knows about that divine power that is encircling him. But his servant initially can't see it. His servant is initially blind to those chariots of fire that are on their side. I wonder, brothers and sisters, if you see the chariots of fire with you today. If you see the wealth of power and help that is available to you, if you were to simply trust, if you were to simply call on the Lord for help. As we reflect on what Isaiah 30 and 31 has taught us this morning, I think an excellent prayer we could all start praying is what Elisha prayed for his servant. "Oh Lord, open up my eyes. Let me see. Let me remember your great power this morning. Let me turn to you first for help before anything else. When I see trouble, help my first instinct to be calling on you. Let that be my knee-jerk reaction when trouble comes my way." It's going to take faith. It's going to take trust. And God may not answer in the way that you expect him to. But if we call on the Lord in times of trouble, we can be confident that he will answer. So let us do so with ever-increasing trust and confidence. Would you pray with me?